I'm Tom. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
and I'm very glad to be here tonight. And for myself, it's a very special welcome to those special people, the spouses of the alcoholic, visitors and guests. All the way from Australia, and I'd like to hear a nice USA welcome for Wendy.
Good day from WA. My name's Wendy. I'm an alcoholic. That's really great hearing that. We don't do that kind of stuff in Perth, because over there you just sit there and you... It's totally different AA here. It's kind of like 30 people's a big meeting. You'll have to bear with me, I'm a little bit nervous. I've been in AA 7 years sober now, and I started drinking when I was relatively young, about 13. I had my first drink in high school, and that first drink I got drunk, and ever since then I had trouble with alcohol, because every time I got hold of it I used to get drunk, and that was it. I was put in hospital 3 times before I was 15 because I just used to drink too much, and then I sat my junior high certificate and I passed, and I got such a shock that from passing the exams that I stayed sober all that summer holidays, and that was a real big thing. And then my parents put me in a private college, and that lasted 6 weeks. Because I was the only I was the only day student there, and I used to sit outside and smoke, and you weren't allowed to smoke in this college, and they kicked me out. I don't know why. I was a good student, really, but then my alcoholism, I started, I did everything back to front as an alcoholic. I did my geographicals then. I'd went from Melbourne 6 times to get away from my parents then, because I couldn't, they were the cause of my drinking. That's what I thought anyhow. And so I used to run away. That's like going from New York to San Francisco. 6 times I did that before I turned 19. And every time I got over there, I'd get a job, get myself together, and as soon as I got my first paycheck, I'd blow it, and that was it. I'd start the whole merry-go-round again. When I was 19, I met the guy who was in AA, and we were going out a fair bit. I was still drinking. And then I used to sit outside the meetings for a long time, and I used to identify with him. I said, that's funny, I do those kind of things. And he took me to my first meeting when I was 19. It was at a hospital. And I was so scared in the meeting, I chain smoked through the whole meeting, and I fainted twice after the meeting, and I was so embarrassed. And I never really identified as an alcoholic then, but I used to keep going around meetings. And my alcoholism got worse. At one stage I was the secretary of a group, and over there you don't have the sips or anything, and I used to make the coffee and everything, and people, I used to go out and get drunk. It was a toss-up whether I went to the meeting or whether I got drunk. And the secretary, the people in the group used to say, oh, don't say anything if you got drunk. We won't say anything and we'll keep you on as secretary. And that's how it went on in Perth. You have to be there to understand how stupid it was. I mean, anyhow, I got to the stage where my drinking, I was doing 2 jobs at one time. I was starting work at 6 o'clock in the morning, and I was working to 3, and then I had a night job, and then I'd go out drinking all night, and then on the way to work I was dragging friends out on the way to work to have a drink with me. I just drank around the clock. I used to drink on the job. I used to hide these bottles of alcohol in my tea trolley when I used to fill up urns, because I worked in the hospital cafeteria. And eventually I just couldn't, my body just couldn't take the drinking and the nights and the heavy living I was doing. And this one particular time I was at work, and I'd driven to work. I'd had a small bottle of vodka on the way to work, and I was drunk as anything, and I went straight in and making sandwiches, And my boss said, "Hey, you're drunk." I said, "No way." And I was trying to prove how sober I was by walking this straight line. And anyhow, they put me into casualty and I just passed out. And a couple of hours later, this is a big hospital, you've got to understand. A couple of hours later, I woke up and had to go to the ladies' room. And the nurses said, "Oh, go in the one in the casualty department." I said, "Oh, no," because I was still in my uniform and I thought, "I'll show everyone if they've heard that I'm drunk, that I'm not." So I'm going around the hospital saying hello to everyone. And I go into the ladies' room and I've got two black eyes from where I've been crying. And I looked a real mess. Anyhow, I left work and I went missing for a week. I don't know what happened that entire week because I was just drinking. And I went back to work the following Monday and they called me into the office because that morning I couldn't get to work. So I booked a taxi because I didn't want to go to work drunk. And I always remember it, the taxi was just due to come. So I had about two bottles of cough mixture and some Panadol because I thought I have to have something to get to work. And I was sick everywhere on the way to work and I finally got to work and they called me in the office and they said, "Get sober or else." And I thought they were going to sack me, but they put me on holidays. And I just went berserk over that last 4 weeks of my holidays and finally I went back to work and they put me in the nurse's quarters because I said I could never get sober at home. Anyhow, that's when Jack came over, because we never had steps meetings till then, and I hadn't been going to AA for quite a while then, and I was friends with his daughter at the time, and I knew that he could help me, because I'd met him previous, and anyhow, he came and met me, and he said, "You really want to stop drinking," because no one was helping me at all at that time. And I said yes, so he was starting up a steps meeting, so I joined the steps meeting. And since then I've been doing the steps and I've been sober, that's 7 years now. It's been a real experience for me because everything I was told to do I did. I didn't believe in it, but now everything's working out really good. I've gone through so many stages since I've been doing the steps. At first, when I started working back at work, I used to be really mad with everyone because I used to get all the horrible jobs and everything, and everyone would look down on me because I was just an alcoholic. And Jack told me that you work for, you know, for money, not prestige. And everything followed on from that as far as me growing. I've got a father that drinks. I'm hoping one day by the example that he'll want to join AA too. It's such an incredible experience. I always thought that being an alcoholic was a step down, but it's really a step up because I was never living until I joined AA. And every day it gets better. And I just can't believe it. It's just like starting out again, like I never lived before now. That's all, thanks. It's been really great.
And Jack's name may come up. I can remember calling him in Australia. And when he picked up the phone, it was kind of unique to me because, as far as I was concerned anyway, it was just like talking to the guy next door. I felt that I'd known the guy all my life. I had met him about 3 or 4 years ago, but that was only briefly. And that was good for me because it gives me the message that AA works all around the world. And it was really no big thing for Jack. A lot of people looked at me funny and they said, "Gee, you called Australia? How'd you help?" And I had time to reflect on that. It didn't cost much more than a bottle of booze. And let me tell you, I'd rather call Jack and pick up a bottle of booze. I keep my program very simple. And I have a lot of gratitude towards it now. Let me introduce my speaker, Jack.
Good evening, friends. My name is Jack Byrne. I'm an alcoholic. I'm very, very happy to be here tonight. After being in Australia for 7 years, you can believe I'm very happy to be here tonight. Because as you know, everything over there is upside down, backwards, the front. It's terrible, really. You don't know where you are unless you got a scorecard. It's a funny country. It's a lovely country, though. Doesn't never get too cold, and it gets very hot. And I really enjoy being there because I feel very useful. I feel very useful because the country has been kind of shortchanged on Alcoholics Anonymous. The people that first brought AA over there only brought a half a program. They brought drunkologues, and that was it. And the 12 steps were used to cover up the holes in the plaster on the wall. And so we had a bunch of people. When I arrived there, we had a bunch of people running around that were very, very upset and very, very sick people. Some of them were sober, but they weren't happy. They were just dry. And as you know, that's no way to live. So I feel very good being over there. I feel I'm in a good position to be able to help a few people. And to me, that's what life is all about. I'm a very grateful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And anything that I've ever done and anything that I ever expect to do that's of any value in this world is because of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I was just as useless as any one person could be. I was completely unspiritual. And my definition of spirituality is a spiritual person is an individual who is wanted and needed and loved by his actions in this world. And I think now because of Alcoholics Anonymous, people do love me and want me and need me, and that's good. I'm quite happy. I see that nothing much has changed over here in the States. The cops and robbers group is still a cops and robbers group. I can see by the door prizes, they did a little shopping after midnight. And it's a great bunch, I'll tell you, and I've seen people here tonight that I never ever expected to see again. Because when I went over to Australia some years back, about 7.5 years ago, I thought that that would be the last time I would be here in the States. Because I'm not getting any younger, and I'm kind of pushing it a little bit now. But to be here is really beautiful. And I really don't know what to say. I feel like a mosquito at a nudist convention. There's just so much, I don't know where to begin, you see. And I'd like to tell you a little joke first, because sometimes I get a little serious and people think I'm that way all the time. I'm not. I'm a very funny fellow. Not funny that way, you know, just funny. Well, this poor woman was over there in Ireland, and she went up to the pastor in the church, and she said, "Oh, Father, he's drunk again," and she was crying bitter tears. And he said, "Oh, no, not again." She said, "Yes, he's drunk again. He come home last night. Oh, terrible, terrible." And the priest said, "Well, I don't know what we're going to do with him. We've tried everything with him. We've been nice to him. We've been nasty to him." And he said, "I think maybe tonight that maybe we try and scare him. Maybe we get him scared." So he said, "Mary, down the lane that you to your house," he says, "there's bushes on either side of the road, isn't there?" And she said, "Yes, Father, there is." And he said, "Well, tonight," he said, "why don't you put a big sheet on your head and get out there in the bushes? And when himself comes home, maybe you can scare him to death." He says, "Get out there and say, 'Yee, I'm the devil, I'm the devil,' and maybe that'll do it." So here's this poor old soul out there in the midnight, hiding in the damn bushes with a big sheet over her, waiting for himself to come down the highway. And she never heard of Al-Anon, that's for sure. Anyway, here he comes down hitting both sides of the road and singing, and his hat's on the back of his head, and he's having a ball, and she jumps out in front of him, and she says, "Ee, I'm the devil, I'm the devil." And he rears back and he says, "Let me shake your hand, I married your sister." Oh, yeah. I was born an alcoholic. When I say I was born an alcoholic, I should rather describe it the way the doctors would describe it today. I was born with the body chemistry of an alcoholic. And when I got to alcohol, it was a sure bet that I'd become an alcoholic. But you couldn't call me an alcoholic until I took the booze. So I was a kid that was born predisposed to be an alcoholic when I got to alcohol. And I lived a very peculiar life in the early days. When I had to go to bed at night, I couldn't go to bed without they left the light on. And I was the butt of jokes with my brothers and sisters. And I was one of 9 children. And when my father came home drunk, he was an alcoholic too. Only in those days, we didn't call him alcoholic. He was a dirty bum, or he was this, or very that, or something. Whatever, whoever looked at him had a different name for him, anything but alcoholic. And we tried to keep him very quiet, you know, and nobody ever knew that he was drinking, we thought. And my mother would say, don't tell anybody that your father's a drunk, you know, it's a disgrace. So anyway, that was when my father came home drunk, I was petrified. And I was so scared, it was pitiful. And I didn't sleep very well as a kid because I was always waiting for my father to get drunk or get sober or get a job or lose a job. My life was based on alcohol and I didn't drink. It was my father that did the drinking and I did the worrying. And I used to sit between my mother and father at night so they didn't hit each other, you see. And I got very little sleep and very little schooling and I was always petrified. I was always sick to death. I used to go to school in the morning or try to go to school and I would throw up halfway to school, and if I was sitting in the school, sometimes I would have to get up and run out. And I would have to run home and see that my mother was still all right. And I was a very strange kid, people said. They said, there's something wrong with that boy. He's not normal. And he used to take me to doctors and my mother would warn me before he went into the doctor, don't tell him about your father's drinking. And so there I would sit like a dummy and people would ask me, what's wrong with you, Jack? And I would just not say anything because I had been warned. Don't tell anything about your father's drinking. And when I went to school, I would sit in the back of the classroom and hope that nobody called on me. And if the nun did call on me, I would stutter and stammer and I couldn't answer. And everybody used to laugh. And I used to get so furious inside. I used to be so mad at the world. I used to be furious. And when people would laugh at me, I would say, someday I'll straighten you out. And I waited to grow up. I wanted to get real big, real quick. And I wanted to get big so I could get a whole bunch of money together and buy my mother a nice dress for Easter because she never had a dress or a pair of shoes. And Easter time was always when people dressed up, as you know. And I always thought how nice it would be if I had a bundle of money and I could buy my mother a nice dress for Easter. Well, I had my dreams like that, you see, and I used to come home from school and tell my mother, hey, Mom, one day I'll grow up, I'll make a lot of money, and you and I go out to Jersey and live. We'll buy a little house in Jersey, just you and me, all right? She'd say, yeah, all right, Jack. And I'd say, we won't take none of them other dummy kids either, will we? And she'd say, no, we won't take nobody, just you and me. And I say, that's good. And we'll leave the old man, too. I will leave that bum here, too. She said, hi, yeah, we'll leave them all here. And she used to go along with me, you see. And those were my dreams as a kid. And I think I was a pretty nice kid. I was an altar boy, and I went to church, pretty regularly. But I was a little upset to go to church, too. Because I always felt like I didn't belong there. I always felt like I was in the wrong place. But anyway, I'm going to make a long story short here tonight, and I'm going to get along pretty good. I was 12 years old when I took my first drink. I was 12 years old, and I was in a bathroom. I was in the bedroom with my brother, and my brother went under the bed, and he come up with a bottle of wine that the old man had stashed there. And he looked at it, and he pulled the cork out, and he sniffed it, and he smelled it. And I said, what are you going to do with it? He said, I think I'll try it. I said, well, do what you want. He was a dope. He's still a dope. I'm living with him out there now in Lynbrook, and he's still a dope. He's not too bright. But anyway, he looked at that bottle and I looked at him and I said, my God, he was just a kid, don't you see? He was 10 years old. And he acted like he was 10 years old. And I was 12 years old, going on 90. And I just had no time for him. But anyway, he took a drink out of the bottle and he told me how good it was. And I looked at him and he didn't fall over or anything, you know. And I said, is it good? He said, yes, yeah, sweet, it's nice. Why don't you try some? So I took a drink of wine, a kid's trick, at age 12. And I want to tell you something. My whole world changed right there. Right that minute. I was no more scared. I didn't care that my father was in bed drunk and that probably he had lost his job. And I didn't care about anything. I just felt good for the first time in 12 years. I never felt like my brothers and sisters. When Christmas came, I always was worried about whether he was going to get drunk or what was going to happen. And invariably he did, and he'd fall into the tree or he'd break up the windows. And my mother would be running around looking for a few dollars to buy a few toys for kids, and we had no money. And that was Christmas, and I hated it. I hated it. I hated holidays because it made me realize how poor we were. And it made me realize why we were so poor, because it was that bum, my father, don't you see? And I hated his guts. I would have cheerfully killed that man, I tell you. And I used to sit and look at him, and I used to have a milk bottle by my side. And I would say, if he picks up his hand again and hits Mama, I'm going to get him right behind the ear with this milk bottle. I'll kill him. And that was me. And then I took my first drink. And all of that venom went out of me, and I felt good for the first time in my life. And my brother said, let's have another one. And I said, by all means, let's do. So we had two. And then I said, let's have another one. He said, no, if you drink any more of that, you're going to get sick. And I said, you're out of your damn mind. And I said, if the Lord made anything better than this, he must have kept it up there for himself. It ain't here. And I believed it. And what I'm talking about now is the effect of alcohol on the body of an alcoholic. It relieved me of the first and foremost manifestation of the disease that I suffer from. Ungrounded, unfounded fear. That's what the alcoholic drinks for, to bury the ungrounded, unfounded fear. I can drink and I can tell you, Annie, I don't care what I drink. It all tastes the same to me. I'm looking for the effect. I don't care what the hell is in it. As long as it's alcohol, that's what I wanted. Now, I finished that bottle of wine that day. My brother looked at me and I finished the bottle of wine. My mother came. She knocked on the door and said, Jack, your father's sleeping. Hurry up and go in and take a bath. She had the water all drawn. And the last I remember was sliding down into the warm water. And the next thing, it was Sunday morning. And my mother was waking me up and crying bitter tears. And I said, what's wrong? And I sat up in bed like a scared deer. And she said, don't ever, what you did yesterday, don't ever do that again. She said, now I have your father, now I got you. And I said, what are you talking about? She said, you got drunk, you went in the bathtub and you almost drowned. And we had to pull you out of the tub. Your father broke the door off the hinges and pulled you out of the tub before you drowned. And I was 12 years old. And I was a full-blown alcoholic. Because that's the nature of the disease that I suffer from. It has nothing to do with morality, has nothing to do with anything, has nothing to do with religion. I was physically incapable of drinking at age 12. But I was going to continue because anything that made me feel as good as that made me feel, I wasn't about to give it up. And I promised my mother that day, Mom, there's going to be no more of that, so please stop crying. I'll never take another drink as long as I live. And while I was telling her that, I was scheming how I was going to get more. And I told you, I was an Irish Catholic and I was an altar boy. And if you're an Irish Catholic and an altar boy, you can drink all you want. All you got to do is get there a little early in the morning in the sacristy and you can heist yourself a couple. And I used to do that regularly. And I used to go to school and I'd tell a nun, sister, why don't you sit over there in a chair and let me take over the class. That was the morning I had a little wine. But sometime I used to meet alcoholic priests too. And they'd get there a long time before I got there and they had to. And that day I didn't get any. And I would go to school and I would sit in the back of the room and hope that nobody called on me. And if the nun did, she'd say, whatever happened to that smart little boy that was here yesterday? And I would sit there shivering and shaking and wishing that she would go and fly a duck somewhere. Get away from me, leave me alone. And that was a yo-yo that I was on at 12. And I would go along a little bit. My mother came home at 15 when I was about 15 years of age. My mother come home early one morning from early shopping. And I had just gotten in while she was out, because I was running with a bunch of nasty people down the west side of New York. She got home and found me sitting in the kitchen, and my father sitting at the other side of the table. And I had brought a bottle of whiskey home, and I brought a roll of stolen money home with me. And I threw it all on the table, and I dared my father, go take one of my dollars or take a drink out of my bottle and I'll kill you. And I had a .32 revolver sitting on the table too. And my mother looked at me and she said, my God. And she took me by the back of the neck and threw me out the door, and she said, don't come back, and take your filthy stolen money, I don't want none of it, and take your filthy whiskey with you, and don't come back. And I asked her then, I said, how come you do this to me, but you put up with him? He ain't got nothing. I got more than he's got, at least I got some money. And she said, because he's not like you. He may drink, and he may not be the best father in the world, but he's not like you. He's not vicious. And she said, you're vicious. And you've done nothing ever since the moment that you were born but hate everybody you ever come in contact with. And I looked at her and I said, all right, if that's the way that you want it, that's the way you got it. And out I went. And if you think that I was bad when I left that house that morning, the anger and the hatred in me was like a festering cancer. And I got much worse. And I'll stand here today and tell you that I've been arrested any number of times, and I've done a lot of nasty, despicable things in my life, and I've hurt a lot of people, and I've stolen a lot of money. And there ain't no excuse in this world for me except one thing, that I'm an alcoholic, and I didn't know what that I was doing. And I drank because I didn't know what else to do. I drank because I had to drink, I felt. I didn't think there was any which way in this world for me to live. So I drank. And when I drink, like it tells us in the second step of our program, I was insane. I was not responsible for anything that I did. And people all along the way told me, Jack, you nice fellow, but you drink too much. You drink too much. You shouldn't drink. And I would say, you out of your mind. He said, Jack, why don't you be like me? Take two drinks and go home. And I tried for many, many years to take two drinks and go home, but it never worked. And I tried every trick in this book to drink without getting in trouble. But every time I drank, I got in trouble because, as I said right here in the beginning, my name is Jack Brennan. I'm an alcoholic. One drink is too many, and 500 is not enough. When I take that one drink in my mouth and it goes down in my stomach, it starts a physical compulsion that I can't turn off. And I have to drink until I fall down dead on my face, or they lock me up and put me in a jail or a hospital or a straitjacket. I can't stop drinking once I start. And that's the physical disease of alcoholism. And it's taken me to some very strange places, really. I drove a car, a getaway car in New York for a nasty bunch of people. And I drove that car for a good many years. And I did a lot of nasty things that I regretted, and there's one thing that I always remember every day. Every morning that I woke up, I would sit on the end of my bed, and I would feel in my pocket for money, and I would wonder, my God, what did I do last night? I would find money in my pocket, and then I'd be afraid of where that I got it. And the second thing I did was smell my gun and see if it had been fired the night before. I never remembered. And the third thing that I would do, I would reach out and take a morning drink, because I was never more than 2 foot from a bottle. I lived to drink, and I drank to live. And this is the way that I lived, and one day things started to change, because that bunch that I lived with there, or that I worked with, that I drove the car for, they called me into the office one day, and they said, hey, Jack, we'd like to see you come in. So I came in, and I said, what's up? And I was scared in my stomach, because these guys, they play rough. And they said, you know, you're a nice fella, and you're probably the best wheel man in New York. But we think that you might have a problem, and that we think maybe you drink a little too much. And you know, Jack, what would happen if instead of taking us home some night, you took us to a police station? What would happen? because you don't know what you're doing when you drink. So I had to agree with them. I tried to argue them out of it, but they said no, and they said, that's it, you had it, and, you know, get yourself lost. So I got lost, and I went out on my own. And I got in a lot of trouble because, you know, I went down Baltimore, Maryland one time, and I was going to knock off a place down there. And it was a bar and grill that cashed checks across from the American Can Company. And I watched this joint for about a week or 2 weeks. I watched how they paid the money out and when they paid it out and how many people were there. And I knew all about it. And they paid on a Friday afternoon, and people come over, the girls come over, cash their checks. And I was going to get it there about 4 o'clock in the afternoon on a Friday. And one day I went in that place, and I thought I'd get about $30,000, $40,000. Instead, I got about $40,000. Because instead of getting there on Friday, I got there on a Thursday. I thought it was Friday. And I stuck the joint up, and there was nothing in it. And I just about got out of town with my skin. So these are the stupid things that happened to me drinking. And now, it's very funny, you know, some of the things that happened, but I look back and I don't feel very funny at all about it. It's very sad, really. The most important thing that happened to me was that I got married along the way somewhere. I had a very lovely wife. She was a very, very simple girl, not simple-minded, just a plain, simple girl. And my drinking did a lot of things to her. It made her a very nasty individual. And I remember she used to beg me to stop drinking, and I would promise her, and I promised everybody. And I had a little job here. I could never hold a job, and she was on welfare, and things weren't doing too good. And I couldn't get a job doing my regular business. No one would have me. And I used to say, well, I'll go down to Mulberry Street, and I'll get a gun, and I'll get started again. But that was impossible. Nobody would give me a gun no more. I was washed up and dead. But anyway, what happened was that this girl, one day, she had enough of me. And she told me to get the hell out of her life. And I went out and I come back and I went out and come back. And finally, one day, she took me to court. Because, you see, I had been going around in New York, and I had a lot of trouble with the cops. I really don't know why, but I had a lot of trouble with cops. And they were the bane of my life, really, because it seemed like every cop had my picture in his hat. And every time I walked down the street, one of them would get in the way and say something nasty, and then we'd tangle up, and there we go. Well, I got beat half to death about 12 times. And they dropped me into a straitjacket, and they put me in Kings County Hospital 12 times. And I remember waking up in a straitjacket. It's not a nice feeling at all. You wake up, you don't know what's happened. My head would be half caved in, and my jaws would be broken, and I'd be a mass of stitches. And I'd wake up and I'd say, oh my God, again. And I'd find out later that I had been fighting with a cop again, you see. I'd walk along the street, and I don't know why, I always got tangled up with cops. And it'd be the tattoo on my head, and away we'd go. Well, that happened to me 12 times, and the 12th time that it happened, I got out of that hospital that particular day, and two detectives met me. And they carried me over to a courthouse in Brooklyn. And my wife was there, and my child was there with my wife. And the judge told me, Jack, he said, we're going to do something for you, he said, because you won't stop drinking. And he said, your wife has made application for you to be taken from your home. Have you got anything to say about that? And I said, yeah. I said, I don't want to hurt her. She said, you don't want to hurt us, but you're going to hurt me, and you've hurt me, and I'm afraid you're going to kill one of the children one day. So I was standing there with a knot of fear in my belly, and I didn't know what was happening, really, because I was that sick. And what happened was that the judge said, Jack, it's impossible for us to leave you in that home. He said, we have to remove you. He said, we've done everything in this world to help you, and you refuse to stop drinking. And the doctors have told us that you are in bad shape. And he said, they say that you won't live for the next 5 years, and if you do, it'll be in a madhouse, completely brainless. And he said, it's impossible for you ever to work again a day in your life. And the doctors also said that you don't know the difference between right and wrong. And he said, you might wipe your family out overnight and not know that you even did it. And he said, so we have to take you away from your family, and you go to New York and don't come back. And if you go to New York and you come back, and we're going to put you away for good in a mental institution. So I went to New York and I said to my wife, hey, I want to tell you something, kid. You're going to need me before I need you. And I said, if that's the way you feel, that's okay with me. And out I went, very defiant. Two cops walked me to the subway and they threw me over the turnstile. And they said, don't come back, bum, because we're going to beat you to death. We had you up to the eyeballs. So I went to New York full of big ideas. I was going to go over there and I was going to go down Mulberry Street, meet some of my friends, and I was going to do this and I was going to do that. All dreams of the alcoholic. All dreams. You know how bad it is? Tomorrow I'll do this, tomorrow I'll do that, tomorrow I'll do the other thing. So I went to New York and I didn't get to Mulberry Street. I got down below Canal and I lived on the Bowery then for about the next 2 years. And I sleep in the streets, in the rain, in the snow. And I curse God every time I open my eyes. I curse God with a vengeance. I said, look what you did to me. And I'm the kid that loved my mother so much, and I'm the kid that hated my father so much. And look what you did to me. And I cursed my father, and I cursed my mother. And if you walked by me and you had clean shoes on, I had none, I'd spit at you. I hated you. I hated everything. I hated everybody. And I lived like a rat in a trap for about 2 years. And I drank smoke, and I drank wine, and I drank anything that I could get my hands on, because I couldn't stand the stink of me. And I lived like that, and one day, my friend upstairs got into the picture. We have only recently here lost Kay Hall, and Kay was a good friend of mine. And she always referred to the higher power as the gentle giant. And how lovely that is. Because this gentle giant, as she called him, got into my life about that time. One day I went into a filthy bar on the Bowery in New York, and I went into the filthy toilet that was in the filthy bar. I'm sure that none of you people would use either. But I went into that toilet because my morning drink always came up. And I had a bottle of smoke that particular morning, and I desperately tried to get one down, and I couldn't. And with about the third throw up that I had, half of my stomach come up with it. I had hemorrhages in the stomach. And I felt so sick and so weak and so dead that I collapsed in that toilet. I collapsed and I hooked my chin on that filthy, dirty toilet bowl on the Bowery. And I lay there and I didn't know what was happening to me. And suddenly I started to see pictures in my mind. I guess that I was hallucinating. I started to see pictures of my wife and my kids and good times, and I started to see a lot of things there, and just like a kaleidoscope coming in front of my head. And one picture I saw, I didn't understand. It was like I was in a light on a ceiling looking down at a whole bunch of people all nicely dressed walking about with coffee cups. And I said, what the hell is that? And suddenly it occurred to me what that it was. My wife one day had taken me to an AA meeting some years before, and she had bribed me with two drinks, a drink to get on the subway and a drink when I got off. And she said, if you only come to AA, I'll buy you a drink. So I went to AA, and I sat in the back of the room, and I laughed at the people that were speaking. And one guy had the nerve enough to get up here like I'm up here tonight. And he said, if you don't take the first drink, you won't get drunk. And I said, I get near enough to you, I'll kill you, you bum. I didn't come all the way from Brooklyn to hear that. I know that. How the hell can you get drunk if you don't drink? You see, I had the answer, but I rejected it. And I got out of that meeting just before the cops arrived. And my wife said, my God, you're hopeless. I said, you're hopeless. Don't ever take me near them places again. Those people are crazy. Now laying on a floor in a filthy toilet on the Bowery, that come back to me with a rush. And I took the bottle I had in my hand that I couldn't drink, and I threw it over my shoulder. And I said, that's it, and I don't care if I live or die. I don't care what happens. I don't want no more to drink. And for the first time in my life, I put my troubles, my finger on my trouble. My trouble with alcohol. And I knew it that day. And for the first time in my life, too, I made a sensible decision. I said, if only I could get to AA now. If only I could get there. And I crawled out of that toilet on my hands and knees. And I got out on the sidewalk. And I would ask you to picture what I looked like. Filthy, dirty, devilish, full of blood, no shoes on, no socks on my feet. Dirty, filthy shirt all ripped to ribbons and filthy trousers on. No underwear. A beard down here, down the back of my neck, full of body lice and filth. And I begged people to call AA for me. And a lot of people pushed me on my back and they said, get away from me, you drunken bum. And finally somebody stopped, and I don't know who that it was, and they said, all right, we'll call AA, but you sit there. Don't move, just sit there. So I sat there and I waited, and I sat on my hands and I shook and I shivered, and I died, and I thought I was hallucinating again. I said, maybe I'm even dreaming. And then finally they come back and said, they're coming, and you stay there and wait for them. So I stayed there and I waited. And while I was there, I made up my mind. I'm never going to have another drink, no matter what. I don't care. And here come a little guy and his wife. He was about this big and she was about that big. And he walked up to me and he said, are you Jack? I said, yeah, I'm Jack. And he said, I'm Sam Cohn, and I'm here to help you. Do you want to stop drinking? And I said, ah, yeah, I want to stop drinking good. And he said, good, then I could help you. And his wife kept saying, oh my God, look at him. And he kept telling her, Jean, be quiet, please. And she said, yes, I know, but oh my God, look at him. And he couldn't get her to shut up for nothing. And then he said, that's all right, come on, we're going to take you to AA, and you're going to be all right. And I said to him, are you sure? And he said, yeah, I'm sure. I said, but the doctors, he said, I don't give a damn what the doctors say. You come with me and Jean, and we'll carry you to AA, and you're going to be all right. You're going to be fine. So I came with him and Jean, and he sat me down in a Hotel St. George in Brooklyn, in the mirror room of all places. When I walked in there, I could see 40,000 of me in the mirrors. And he sat me on a little ledge that runs around the room, the heating element. And I asked him years later, I said, Sam, why did you sit me on that little ledge and you sit me in a chair? He said, man, he said, we thought you were going to fall off and break an arm. You couldn't sit in a chair. Well, that was my first AA meeting. And Sam was right. I never had to take another drink. And I want to say something to you, that there is no mystery to this program. There is no secret messages here. There is no tremendously complicated bits here. It's very simple. It has to be simple for an idiot like me. And the answer is here, that if you put the cork in a bottle and put the bottle in a closet and make your last drink, then you don't have to drink no more if you come to AA. And when all else fails, follow the directions. Because the 12 steps of AA are the program of AA. There is a definite program to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you come to AA and sit and drink a lot of coffee, all that happens to you is that you get diarrhea. That's all. And my friend Johnny Harris, down in San Francisco, San Diego rather, he has a little something that he says, and I agree with him completely. Sitting at an AA meeting will not make you a member of Alcoholics Anonymous any more than sitting in a chicken coop will make you a chicken. And by God, that's right. That's exactly right.
Because I came into AA, and it's 40 years ago. I come into AA 40 years ago without shoes on my feet, without teeth in my head, half blind in one eye and unable to speak or talk or do anything. And all I did was follow directions. When Sam said, sit down, I sat down. And when he said, stand up, I stood up. Because I'm a maniac and I was completely devoid of being ability to make a sane decision. So Sam made all my decisions for me. And I held on to that little Jewish fellow, God rest him, for dear life. Because I wanted to be sober. And I didn't care what that it took, I was going to be sober. And if I died in the interim, that was okay. I was going to die sober. I figured that at least they'd go home and tell my wife, well, he tried. At least he was sober when he died. Little did I know what was in store for me. What was in store for me was a complete new way of living. And I put these steps into my life just as soon that I possibly could. And I went to a step meeting each and every week. I went to a step meeting because that I wanted to learn how to live with my disease because I was never going to get rid of it. And when I got along on the steps a little bit, Sam would say to me, how you going? I'd say, fine. And he would, and then one day he said to me, Jack, what are you going to do about the third step? And I said, I knew you'd get to that. Because me and my friend upstairs, we didn't talk too good when I first arrived here at AA. I was ashamed. I was ashamed of all the nasty things that I had done. And I told Sam, I said, why do you have to bring God into it? He said, because it's impossible to do it otherwise. And I said, how do you figure that, Sam? He said, well, I'll explain it to you. Do you have any money in your pocket? I said, yeah, I got a couple of bucks. He says, good. Are you working? I said, yeah, I got a job washing dishes. You know that. He said, you got a room? I said, yeah, I got a room. Pay $4 a week for it. You got to step outside to change your mind, but that's all right. It's mine. And he said, you're doing real good, aren't you? You're not drinking. You're not shaking no more. You're not bleeding no more. I said, that's right. What are you driving at? He said, who did all these nice things for you? I said, you. No. No. Don't you give me credit that I don't have. He said, I didn't do anything for you. The man upstairs sent me out to get you, and I picked you up, and I carried you to AA. And from then on, you have been under the care of the higher power, whether you know it or not. And he said, all these nice things that have happened to you is because God loves you. And that floored me. I said, how could God love me? He says, I don't know. He says, I find it hard sometimes too. He said, but God must love you, because look what he did for you. Now, you know, you can't reject truth. And I stood and I looked at me, sober, with shoes on my feet. And I had a room. I had a couple of dollars. I was eating good. I wasn't bleeding no more. Everything was coming up glued for me. And Sam Tong had to insisted that the guy upstairs was doing it all for me because he loved me. I had to accept it. I said, oh, if you tell me that, then I'll believe it. And I said, Sam, how do I get next to the guy upstairs? He says, very easy. When you go home tonight, don't take the bus. Walk. And talk to your friend upstairs. I said, how do I do that? He said, talk to him just like you talk to me. And he said, no, wait a minute. In your case, clean it up a little bit. Because I tell you, I was very uncouth. I lost my couth a long time ago. So anyway, that night I went out and I talked to my friend upstairs. And I told him, I said, hey, that little Jewish guy in there said that you love me, and it must be. It's got to be. I believe it. And I said, I want to tell you something. From here on in, whatever you want me to do, you tell me. And whatever it is, to the best of my ability, I'll do it. And for the past 40 years, that's what he's been doing. Been telling me what to do, and I've been doing it to the best of my ability. I've had a lot of trouble in my life. I lost my wife, and she died, and very suddenly, and I almost lost my mind, I think, at that moment, because I came out of a hospital in Mount Kisco, and she was dead inside, and had on an undershirt and no shirt, and I was bitter cold. And I sat on a fender of my car, and I started to rant and rave at my friend upstairs. And suddenly, it occurred to me, Jack, that's wrong. I was going back to where I used to be, saying, what did you do to me now? And suddenly it occurred to me that I had had my wife at that time for the past 24 years. And we had had another child. And everything was good. And now he took her. And I couldn't find anything wrong with that when I thought about it logically and sensibly. So I buried my feelings and I went home and we properly buried her and that was the end of that. Well now, as I've told you before, I live in Australia, married again to my child bride over there. And jealousy will get you nowhere, fellas. And I'm having a ball and everything is good. And I want to say this to you. There is nothing in this world that comes down a chute in my life that I will not accept. And I think that that is the spirit that the third step put into my life. Whatever comes down a chute comes from the higher power for me. And if it's good, bad, or indifferent, I just have to sit a little bit and wait. And if it's bad, it gets better. And if it's good, it gets better too. So I know that the secret to this program is to turn your life and will over to the care of God, put the steps into your life to the best of your ability, and then wait and hang on because you're going to go for a ride that you never, ever believed. The things that have happened to me since I'm sober, I could stand here all night and tell you all about it, but I won't. I know we got to get finished and we got to get out of this place pretty early tonight. So I'm going to just kind of leave it there. AA is a wonderful experience for me. And it can be a wonderful experience for anybody that wants it. All you have to do is, like I said before, put the cork in a bottle, put the bottle in the closet, make the last drink your last drink, and hang on. Because life is going to be better than you ever, ever expected. Now I'd like to leave you tonight with a little thing that we have here. I wake up in the morning and I put my feet on the floor. And the moment that I put my feet on the floor, I realize that I've been given another 24 hours to live. And that's a beautiful feeling for me because I should have been dead many, many years ago. I'm not. So when I put my feet on the floor in the morning, I kind of shake my head a little bit and get the cobwebs out. And then it occurs to me the gratitude that wells up inside me because I have been given another day in a beautiful home that I live in with a lovely wife that I have and the world is all right with me. So I get close to my higher power then. And that little thing that goes through my mind always is that I meet my God in the morning when my day is at its best. And his presence comes like sunrise, like a glory in my breast. And all day long this presence lingers, and all day long he stays with me. And we sail in perfect calmness over a very troubled sea. So I think I know the secret, learned from many a troubled way. You must seek him in the morning if you want him throughout the day. And when I have that little thing in my heart and in my head, then I'm ready for another day. And with that, I want to leave you here now, and if you ever get over to Perth in West Australia, be sure and look me up. And you'll find me there just as long as the good Lord lets me live. I'll be there, and I'll be happy, and I'll be doing just exactly what I'm doing tonight, trying to tell you about the beauty that AA is. Thank you all, and God bless you.